The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Great, good morning. So I guess the topic for today is the concept of the sacred. And does Buddhism have anything that's sacred? And what is the sacred? And one of the aspects of words like the sacred and spiritual is that it's very easy to use them and in such a way that people are inspired, the sacred, the spiritual, some people. Whereas the people using the word don't have the same reference for what it means. So it's a wonderfully vague word, and we can evoke the sacred, and everyone thinks they know what it means, and everyone's inspired. But maybe there's very different understandings and definitions of what it is. One of the things that's interesting about Buddhism is that Buddhism didn't get started in the English language. And it got started in other languages, Indic languages, and then other languages in Asia. And there's some English words, Western words, which proved to have a poor fit with Buddhism as it was spoken or written in traditional texts. And so the word spiritual, you know, where does, you know, Buddhist teachers, even I use the word spiritual often enough, but there's no, you know, if you want to translate spiritual back into the language of the Buddha, you'd be hard pressed to find out what, you know, what's a good thing. And then the word sacred as well, perhaps. Also the word, even the word Buddhism, you'd have a hard time finding a good match for the word Buddhism in most traditional Buddhist languages. There's words like the Buddha's teachings, which are often used as substitutes, but the word Buddhism is a kind of a Western invention. And then the other word that's kind of interesting is the word religion. Some countries had to coin a word to translate the English word religion or into their language. And so in Japan, they kind of made up a word when they encountered the West in the 1800s or so. You know, but it's such an obvious, you know, for many people who grew up speaking English, it's like an obvious word, right? It's like, doesn't everyone have a religion? I mean, it's Buddhism, sacred, spiritual. So I didn't grow up with any religion, and particularly didn't grow up with Christianity or Judaism. And I started to encounter, especially Christian practitioners, after I was a Buddhist teacher, having more deeper conversations with them and exploring their shared religious life. And one of the things that took a little while for me to understand was the starting point for the discussions for what was religion was very different. And one of the, and maybe it's difficult to see that from, if someone grew up here in a Western theistic religion, it might be hard to kind of see that difference. But if someone didn't grow up in a theistic religion, perhaps to me, for example, it stood out, like, wow, it's very different. And as I understand it, maybe I don't understand these religions very well, but what I've seen is that people who come out of a Judeo-Christian background have a very strong idea that the sacred is out there, that what's divine is out there. And there's a relationship you have with what's divine, a relationship that you have with God. And God has, hopefully, a good relationship with you. But that relationship is very important. And so there's always, almost always going to be this kind of distance or separation between you and the sacred, you and the divine. And establishing the right relationship to that is very important. Sometimes some people have said that certain kinds of theistic religions, that the idea of God fits very well into various kinds of paternal ideas that people have, of parental ideas people have of what a parental figure should be, and people hold the God up that way, and you relate to the person in that kind of way. So this is the idea of a relationship to something. Whereas in Buddhism, the way that I was introduced to it and practiced it was that there was no God out there. There was no thing out there, sacred realm out there. There's no heaven out there that we're supposed to be in relationship to. And so when I've been involved in Christian Buddhist dialogue, sometimes I've seen deists perplexed by me, completely confused, like, what? How can this even be a religion if there's not this relationship with this thing out there, which is the sacred realm or the divine or something like that? And, you know, maybe I'm perplexed too, because why do we need it? Why do we need that relationship? And maybe I'm drawn, because of that, I'm drawn to some of the Christian mystics, a little bit I've read, because it seems that what I've read is that some of them, that as you go into the dimension of God, relating to God, God kind of dissolves or falls away, or the concepts of God falls away, and you can't have a concept of God, so that falls away, and so it doesn't become an other out there. Maybe it just is. But what does Buddhism have as sacred if it doesn't have something which is the other, which is sacred, something you can relate to, that thing which is going to be the thing, the divine? The word sacred, is connected to the word profane. Profane means that, literally, apparently means in Latin, that which is in front of the temple. And so the temple is a sacred place. So with the word sacred, there's a division, a divide between that which is profane and that which is divine or special. And some people have felt that live a very strong divide between that which is profane and sacred. And some people have seen the body as being profane or the world as being profane. And what's sacred is some other dimension, some other place, or maybe in the church, or maybe in heaven, or maybe connected to the saints or God or whatever it might be. The other thing about the word sacred that's changed, I think, in our society over these last, I don't know, century or two or more, is that I believe that it used to be that what was considered sacred had a certain, it certainly had power to it, and was something that people were partly afraid of. There was fear and awe connected to the sacred, and you don't want to cross a line, you don't want to mess with what's sacred. And that's true in many societies where there's a taboo about around certain religious kind of activities. And you don't want to mess with the religious dimension of life because it can come back and trouble you. But you know what's in the last 100 years? I don't know how long, especially here in the modern West, reality has been domesticated, and spirituality and religion has been domesticated to a great degree. And so the idea of being afraid of the sacred is not something that seems very current, or certainly not very popular, at least among people that I talk to or hang out with. There's a domestication of it, and I wonder what's lost when things get domesticated, when things, you know, everything becomes seen through the filter of being tame or being easy or being comfortable or being kind of everything has to accommodate itself to me, you know, and everything's become safe. The idea of everything should be safe and comfortable, I don't know, maybe that's a middle-class dream. So the sacred. So traditionally the word that probably comes, in Buddhism, that comes closest to the word sacred is the word, in Pali, it's Arya. And it's an ancient word. It refers to a certain people originally, the Aryans. And it gave us the name of Iran. The Aryan people who came in from the steppes of Russia or someplace and came into India about, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, the Aryan invaders, and got established there. And they became a little bit among the ruling class of ancient Indians, and kind of created seemingly a divide between the natives and the Aryans. And over time, over the thousands of years, and by the time you get to Buddhism, the word Aryan was still being used, and the Buddha used it for particular kinds of people. And not the people who were born as the Aryans, who came from a particular lineage of people, but rather the Buddha redefined the term to a particular people who had certain spiritual attainments. And because of the word Aryan is a difficult word for many people still to this day because of Germany and all that in the West, the usual way of translating to English is as nobles. And so the four Aryan truths of Buddhism are the four noble truths. the four Aryan are the four Aryan people are the four levels of enlightenment that people can, Buddhism says, you can attain. But we call them the noble ones. The noble ones is the usual English translation of all this. And so here, what's considered sacred is not found in a reality outside of people, but in the people who have a certain level of attainment. Now, sometimes in Buddhism, then, those people are considered as sacred. And there's a lot of funny business that goes on among Buddhists about these special people who have attainments and they're highly, spiritually mature. And, people want to be close to them. They want to get merit from them. They want to have certain charisma. And so how you treat those people is very important. There's a lot of superstition sometimes around those people. And the craziest little superstition I heard in Thailand was of a soldier who went into the toilet after a very highly attained monk had used it to collect a little piece of his poop, put it in a little bottle, and kept it because he thought then if he kept it in battle, he'd be safe. He wouldn't be shot, So these noble people are seen sometimes as having very special qualities. So if you sacred poop. But still, they are repository. The closest word to the sacred in Buddhism is probably Arya, Aryans, or these the noble ones. But if you don't focus on them out there as being those people, again, having a relationship to something outside of you that's going to save you or benefit you, the idea is to have the focus back on yourself here. Understand what goes on in your own mind, what goes on here with you. And one of the things that we can begin understanding is how the mind creates all kinds of divisions. And the mind creates a division of inside and outside. The mind creates a division, from Buddhist point of view, the mind creates a division between sacred and profane. The mind creates the division between good and bad. As Shakespeare said, maybe it was Hamlet who said, there is no good and bad, but people make it so. The idea that a huge role that our mind has in creating how we see the world that we live in. And so one of the aspects of Buddhist practice is to begin understanding very well what our mind is doing, how the mind creates concepts and ideas that we live in. And one of the things we see is the divide. So if we're suffering, or say differently, if there is hate, we live in a divided world. You have to live some self and other out there, create a strong separation to have hate for someone or for anything. The same thing with greed and lust. There's a divide, there's separation. And if we live, and also probably fear to some degree as well. And those movements of greed and hate and lust and fear create suffering for us. And so one of the ways of understanding suffering, if we suffer, we're living in a world that's somehow divided against ourselves. There's a certain kind of tension and stress. And that as we sit and practice and learn to dissolve that stress or that tightness or let go of or dissolve the greed and the hate, then the divisions that those create start falling away. And one of the remarkable things to experience is a mind that has no hard and fast separation between self and other. This mind that the awareness that can hold everything, the awareness that doesn't have an idea of what's acceptable and not acceptable. This is not okay. Not acceptable in a particular way. Acceptable or not acceptable to receive it in an open heart, to receive it in an open mind. Anything that can't be received in an open heart and open mind is then put outside. Profane, outside of what's acceptable. And then there's something which is acceptable, something that's special. And so then we're trying to protect ourselves or protect what we think is who we are, protect ourselves from what we think is dangerous or difficult or not appropriate or not sacred. And that creates that divide which Buddhism is trying to heal. So if the sacred is set in opposition to the profane, Buddhism doesn't have much role for it. Then we're trying to heal that divide. And where it heals is not in our ideas. It heals in the mind that relaxes, the mind that opens up, the heart that relaxes and opens up, the heart that's willing to be open and receive everything. And so as Sharon Salzberg's book title says, the heart that's as wide as the world, to create kind of ability to say yes in a certain way to everything, let it come here, not to hold things away. And that's a difficult thing to do because we have a lot of conditioning within us that gets triggered by many of the things that go on in the world. And we get afraid, we get hurt, we get full of desire or hostility, all kinds of things go on where we of the conditioning we have. And so part of this idea of Buddhism, practice, is to be very careful and compassionate and sensitive to how difficult it is to begin living in the world in an open heart, in an open mind. But that's the direction that we're going. And so break down the divides that the heart makes. It doesn't mean that the conventional distinctions disappear entirely, but it means that they occur within a heart that's as wide as the world. They occur within this wider kind of field and context. So one of the practical ways in which this plays itself out in Buddhist practice is, which for me was really one of the powerful lessons I had from Zen practice, was that everything you do, everything you encounter is sacred. Everything that, so it isn't that there's some things which are more sacred than others, but that everything you encounter is sacred, not because it's sacred in and of itself, because that, remember, that's establishing this relationship to the things of the world out there. Buddhism doesn't, I think strictly speaking, Buddhism is neither against the world or for the world. It's not celebrating the world, nor diminishing or demeaning the world. The world is what it is. The world is not good. The world is not bad in Buddhist terms. The world is what it is, but how we relate to it is really the main thing that's important for us as an individual. What comes out of us? There's a famous Mahayana teaching that says, if the mind is pure, all things are pure. If the mind is pure, all things are pure. If the mind is not pure, then you'll start seeing all kinds of things being, then we start dividing the world, and then all that. So in Zen, the idea that everything you encounter, you want to meet it with a certain kind of presence. You want to meet it, engage with it, as if it's sacred, or as it's sacred is found in that experience. And so what happens in that encounter? What happens is if you're willing to take everything as being something you give yourself completely to, as being this is it, then you start discovering maybe that you're not really that way. That maybe you have some hesitation. That washing the dishes is not really that special. There are more important things to do. Or driving your car to go and meditate, come here to IMC, right? It's so important for you to meditate, and that's really just kind of sacred and special and spiritual, and that's what's really important. And so driving your car is just kind of like how you get to the sacred, to the special, right? So you don't have to pay attention to driving your car. The faster you can get here, pull some wheelies and, run a few red lights, you can get here in time so you can really be present. Really be present and relaxed and open to things as they are. You want to really encounter the universal sacredness of all of life in particular places, in particular times, when it suits you, right? So how you drive your car? How do you drive your car? Do you drive your car in a way that is sacred? Or drive your car that you discover a special divine quality of life? And so that really depends on what you bring to the situation. Do you bring yourself fully to it? So it's just that one activity. Many people, not so much nowadays, but used to be that because more recently left Buddhist monastic life, people who were not going to become monastics would ask me, well, how could I, as a layperson, get the same benefits of practice as a monastic, living in a monastery? And one of the things I think a good answer for that is when you do something Just really do that one thing when you're doing it. And that's something that would be, you know, you get a lot of the benefits of being a monk or nun. You just really, when you're really present for something, the person you're with, the activity you're doing, the dishes you're doing, whatever you're doing, just really be there for that one thing and engage in it. My certificate, I've always kind of joked that after my years of Zen training, there was a particular Zen activity that I should have gotten my, monastic activity I should have gotten my certificate in Zen training in for. And that was when I first came to the monastery, they put in the meditation hall that was probably twice as big as this room here. They had a platform like I'm sitting on here, a platform that went all the way around the periphery of the room where people meditated on. So it was quite a lot of platforms. So they just built them, and they were getting ready to install them. And for 3 months, my job was to sand the tops of them to make them smooth. So I was given an electric sander, and during my work days, during the monastery, I was sanding. And that was my training in Zen. You know, so the idea was that, you know, you don't think of, you know, Zen monastic life as being a training in sanding. But just give myself over to this activity and just sand. And then, you know, many times I didn't want to do it. I didn't think this was really spiritual. I'd come to the monastery to meditate. What does sanding have to do with anything about Buddhism? Sanding was, you know, just a silly little thing. And so I had all these reactions to it. But as I learned to work through those and just learn to be simpler and simpler and just sand, the sanding became delightful. It was like that was special. Not because what sanding was delightful. What was delightful is not to resist it, not to be judging it, not to be fighting it, not to be just very simply just be there with the sanding. So one of the words, one of the ideas of the sacred for me in Buddhism is the awareness which includes everything. When awareness can be inclusive, then we're in the sacred dimension. When awareness, as soon as awareness excludes something, if that's not okay to be present for, then we have a divided world. And if you have it too divided, then you can, one way a form a divided world can take is a very tight separation between what's sacred and profane, which I think can be a problem if what you want to do is to be that is heart as wide as the world. And so an awareness which is all-inclusive is one of the challenges that we're trying, or one of the tasks of mindfulness practice, to sit. And what is it like to meet this? What is it like to be open to this experience? What's it like not to be pushing away or holding tight to experience, or having preferences for my experience, or being selective of what's supposed to happen, or trying to get rid of what's here to get something better? Just to really just be present for this, to keep opening to this, to find not that things in the world change, but you change in your ability to hold it all. It's the mind that can hold it all peacefully, which I would like to think of as that which is most sacred in Buddhism. So one of the ways that, I don't really like the word sacred too much, but I think a word which I prefer, but just doesn't come off my tongue well enough to want to use, maybe because of other associations, but it's the word holy. And the reason I like the word holy, it comes from the word whole, to be complete. And so so rather than sacred that comes already has this word idea of division in it, sacred and profane, I don't know if the word holy has something that, you know, I guess the opposite is partial, but to be whole, to be complete. And so what is it to see another person as being whole? What is it to see yourself as whole? What is it to have an awareness or a presence or heartfulness that can hold it all and to see ourselves as whole, to see the situation as whole? And that's a very strong preference that I find is the preference to see individuals as being whole or complete, see the situation as complete and whole. And I think the reason I have that preference, that idea seems to be most closely in affinity with the sense of open, relaxed awareness that is not creating divisions, not creating judgments, not creating a problem in the world. You can't underestimate how many problems we have because our mind thinks so. Who was it? Maybe it's Mark Twain. Someone said, I've had a lot of problems in my life, most of them which never happen. So how much does the mind create problems? So I'd like to end with reading a story from my little book, The Monastery Within. It's it has a wonderful, for Buddhists, very bordering on sacred title, because it's such an important value in Buddhism, like one of the highest values and stuff, wisdom and compassion. So this is going to be a very promising chapter. It's such a high, lofty chapter title. You prepare yourself for a lot of wisdom, a lot of compassion, and the depths and fullness of it. Maybe all you need to know about this topic. When it was time for the monastic community to meditate, the new nun headed for the meditation hall. Placing her shoes on the shoe rack, she looked down and saw they were not lined up parallel to each other. This helped her to see that she was slightly distracted due to the excitement of her first day in the monastery. Letting go of her distraction, she looked more carefully at what was in front of her. Placing her shoes on the shoe rack, she looked down and saw they were not lined up parallel to each other. This helped her to see that she was slightly distracted due to the excitement of her first day in the monastery. Letting go of her distraction, she looked more carefully at what was in front of her. She saw that her shoes were old and worn. Remembering when they were new, she reflected on how all things are transient and how quickly they change. Soon, she thought, I will be an old nun in this monastery. Reflecting on how precious each moment was, she reached down to straighten her shoes. Doing so, she noticed that if she moved them to the left, then there would be space for another pair of shoes to the right of hers. Thinking of the other monks and nuns who were coming to the meditation hall, she gently pushed her shoes to the side. Happy, the new nun entered the meditation hall. Wisdom and compassion. I hope you understood. To really be there for that experience fully, and to see the wisdom that in that situation, and the care for others in that situation, all that you needed, all she needed in that moment was to really be present for putting your shoes in the shoe rack. Did you guys do that today? In our shoe racks here? Shoe racks are sacred as much as anything else. Anyway, so I hope that these thoughts about the sacred are interesting for you or useful. Especially want to encourage you to the value of really seeing, being present for each thing that you do, how valuable that is, and each person. And that an all-inclusive awareness is an awareness that allows us to be with other people with a heart as wide as the world, that includes other people, that doesn't divide us and them in all the ways that can be painful for all of us. So I hope that as we come to this end of this year and beginning of next year, that you will be inspired to have a heart that includes everyone, everything. So we have a few minutes. Anyone have any questions or comments or corrections about?
Hello. I like being in the moment. I try practicing that. But one problem with it is time. I get lost.
Yeah, it's a problem with time. You know, life is time-consuming.
Then I'm late. A lot.
Yeah. I saw this with kids. You know, we have, you know, my sons, when they were like in kindergarten or nursery school, you know, it was time to go to school, and they were so much in the moment. We would leave, and they would stop in the front of our house to look at the flowers, and they'd stop and look at the gravel, just really be there with the gravel by the parking lot, and just really be present for the sacredness of that moment, I guess. But you know, at school, you know. So I think that part of awareness that includes everything is also includes an understanding of the context that we live in. And so the context also includes the future, the wider context of our agreements, our life that we live. And if you live too much in the only in the present moment, it's a problem. And it's a problem for other people as well. But to have a heart, the mind that's open to it all, has to be open to the way that the mind functions in all its different ways. And it does function with projections into the future, with making plans, with agreements and understandings of things which are not part of the immediate visible world. And so that's part of what we have to be open to, the functioning of the mind. To have this very narrow idea of what it means to be in the present moment is, I think, is which some people have, leaves too much out. So that, but sometimes we train ourselves to be just really present for one thing when we're doing that, so that we know what it's like to be present. And then with time, we know how to be present and relaxed as we think about what the plans for the day are and what it takes, what it requires to get someplace on time. And it includes reflection of what do I have to adjust, what kind of behavioral changes do I have to make so that I can live my life in a way that's in a relaxed way. So if you have to get someplace on time, and you know you have a tendency to stopping smelling the flowers, then and now you're upset with Buddhism because it says you can, everybody, because you can't stop and smell the flowers because you have to get there on time. I think what is also behavioral changes are necessary, so maybe you need to leave home earlier. Oh, you didn't like that, apparently.
That would solve the problem.
Yeah, so it's very important to, I think it's very, behavioral changes are a very important part of all this. And to expect that everything's going to work magically well if we're just fully present for things is magical thinking. I saw.
I have a question. So one of the things that the awareness has to hold is also when the moment is a bad moment, right? If a lot of anger comes up or fear or hurt, then the idea is that also is a sacred moment, unless you get into the story and the mind starts going building its story. So it's just a matter of kind of holding that.
Yeah, so this is where maybe it's a little cautious around these words. I apologize for bringing the word sacred into your vocabulary today.
Okay.
And a sacred moment, again, maybe implies that it's out there, but it's an opportunity for the sacred awareness. Mm-hmm. And that, I prefer to see what's the most, that which is sacred is the awareness that can hold it. So if you're angry, it's possible to relate to that anger with sacred awareness, with an awareness that doesn't exclude it. It doesn't mean that it now becomes comfortable, but an ability to hold the discomfort in such a way that we're not being pushed around by it, that we're not caught in the grip of it. So how do we open to this experience too? How do we open to anger? To judge anger as being bad or negative, to judge it as something that shouldn't be there, or to judge it as justified, to judge it, I'm right and I'm going to, bulldoze through this world. All those things create more divide. But the task in this sacred awareness is to open the awareness up and hold the anger so we're comfortable with being uncomfortable. We hold the awareness so that, hold the anger so that the anger doesn't control us. But we're also not fighting the anger. We're not in conflict with it.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Here's up here in front.
Thank you. I guess I understood what you said about opening your heart completely, but what about cases where people are injuring you physically or in another way? It just seems, I suppose you could hold that with an open heart, but I think you need to push it away.
Exactly. I agree. So we can hold it in an open heart, but we push away. So what we do with our bodies and our mouths, it's not the same thing that we do with our awareness. And so sometimes when people talk about having open awareness, being open and kind of accepting to everything, and it's understood to be all in, the last, I don't know, sometimes understood too generally. Awareness can be accepting of everything, but our discernment, our understanding of the situation, our mouth, what we say, what we do with our body, doesn't have to accept some things. So saying no, this can't be. say no ferociously. And so it's epitomized by the teaching that I think Munindraji, an Indian teacher in the 70s, it was a woman who was in India, was studying with him, and I guess she asked some question, or maybe it happened to her on the that someone on the street tried to grab her. And so she went back to him and said, "What do I do when someone, you know, grabs me?" And he said, "With all the love that you can muster, you hit the person over the head with your umbrella." And this idea is also held in Buddhist monastic rules. Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on ahimsa, non-violence, non-harming. And monks and nuns are not allowed to have any weapons, not allowed to fight. However, if they're being attacked, they're allowed to push away, so a strike away. So if someone comes with a fist or with a knife, you can knock that fist away or that knife away. You don't have to stand there defensiveless. So the task is how to keep your mind. So it's a lot easier to keep your heart open if you have confidence that you have the ability to say no or to you know, protect yourself or do what's, you know, wise in the situation, if you have street smarts. So yeah, that's a task, is to learn how to do that. But I think sometimes it's easier if we make that distinction between what we say and do versus how our hearts are open, then it's easier to keep our hearts open. Does that make sense? So one more and then we'll stop. Yes.
Your talk was very timely this morning, because it seems like the world is just full of a whole lot of warring attitudes and opinions, particularly in recent months, and a lot of hyperbole and a lot of black and white thinking. And it's really difficult to stay out of that and not participate and try to bring some kind of, if not neutrality, at least some kind of more inclusive thinking to some of the current issues. So I just wanted to thank you.
So inspired me to say one thing. Is that for me, it's been very meaningful, the emphasis that Buddhism gives on the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the ways, a way of studying the divides that we have in this world, to understand something about the psychological roots of it, and while respecting the suffering. If we see the suffering that's in the situation, as opposed to seeing who's right and wrong or what's true and not true, and so, you know, in terms of politics or in terms of whatever. But if we really stop pay attention, here are people who are suffering. And then I think maybe we can start finding the middle ground or the common ground that we all share, and maybe find a way to respect each other and find our way. And if we understand the suffering, then we can also begin understanding the underlying causes of that suffering, the underlying conditions that bring that suffering up. And so there's tremendous suffering in our world, and politics and philosophies and all kinds of views cover over the deeper underlying issues of the heart that are going on. So my hope is that people who do a practice like this, mindfulness practice or Buddhism, are people who are able to not get pulled into the polemics, the divides, the controversies, because they can go kind of underneath it into the deeper human level of what's going on in the heart. And there we can meet each other and explore what's the common good for all of us, not for one side or the other. So, may you end this year being complete, being a heart that's whole and can hold it all. And may you begin next year with awareness and heart that can be as wide as the world. So I'll see you on Sunday next year. Thank you.